Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has four causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which we will hear them, they are as follows. Transport Insurance Company, Lindsay and Newsom Claim Services, and Janet E. Jones versus Paula Triple Faircloth from Tyler County. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation versus Nueces County and Robstown Independent School District from Nueces County. Computer Associates International, Inc. versus Altai, Inc., a certified question from the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, and Texas Department of Public Safety Officers Association and others versus Lane Denton from Travis County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal argument by advising the marshal. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument, of each set of arguments, and we will complete these arguments before our lunch break. The arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court by our clerk, and you may make application with the clerk if you wish to listen to a tape of the arguments. The court is now ready to hear from petitioners in Transport versus Faircloth.
May it please the court, Mr. Arthur Smith will submit arguments to petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Let me make one additional statement. Justice Hightower is ill today, but he will listen to these tapes and participate in the deliberation and decisions.
Thank you. 3 years ago, the petitioners were defendants in the trial court below. Facing claims under a multitude of theories, we were in essence being accused of fraudulently inducing a 15-year-old girl to settle a wrongful death claim arising from the death of a woman believed to be her mother. In June of 1994, 31 days after the putative mother's death, any possible wrongful death type claims of this 15-year-old, the respondent, were settled for $250,000 by Transport Insurance Company, the liability carrier for the trucking company against which any claims could have been asserted. In connection with the settlement, the respondent's interests were represented by her court-appointed guardian, Troy Caldwell, and a court-appointed attorney, Michael Askins of Lufkin, Texas. On behalf of the respondent, Caldwell and Askins presented the settlement for approval by the judge of the probate court in which the respondent's guardianship proceeding was pending. By written order, the judge approved the settlement as fair and reasonable, and after Askins' attorney's fees were subtracted, every dollar of the amount of those settlement proceeds was deposited into a court-controlled bank account for respondent's benefit. In the trial court below, respondent alleged that the value of her claim was actually much higher than $250,000, and that the settlement was the product of a conspiracy between petitioners, Caldwell, and Askins to deprive her of a settlement for a fair amount. In this case, it has been undisputed that at the time of the settlement, petitioners believed that respondent was the legal child of her putative mother, Judith Kirvin, and therefore had standing to bring a wrongful death claim based on Kirvin's death. During the course of discovery proceedings in the trial court below, however, petitioners ended up unearthing two very critical facts. Number one, respondent was neither the natural nor legally adopted child of Judith Kirvin. And number two, Caldwell and Askins had known this all along and realized the need to obtain a settlement for respondent before Transport also became aware of that fact and itself realized that respondent legally had no standing to assert any claims based on Judith Kirvin's death. In the trial court below, respondent herself admitted that she was neither the natural nor adopted child of Judith Kirvin, but only on an offer of proof. Petitioners had also obtained a certified copy of respondent's true birth certificate, which provided the identity of respondent's natural mother. In light of this uncontrovertible proof, petitioners argued in the trial court that since respondent had no legal relationship to Judith Kirvin, which would permit her to bring a wrongful death claim based on Judith Kirvin's death, that respondent had, as a matter of law, suffered no damages as a result of the $250,000 settlement of her non-existent claims. Upon the request of respondent's attorneys, however, the trial judge rejected this argument and prohibited petitioners from rebutting respondent's testimony to the jury that Judith Kirvin was her mother. in regard to respondent's claim that the settlement was produced by a fraudulent conspiracy. Petitioners then sought to introduce evidence that there was, quote, no meeting of the minds, end quote, between them on the one hand and Caldwell and Askins on the other. In this regard, petitioners attempted to introduce the evidence that explained the motivation of Caldwell and Askins in entering into the settlement, i.e., their awareness of respondents' lack of standings, as reflected in Askins' own attorney notes that were also offered in an offer of proof, and their desire to get as much money for her as possible before transport also became aware of that fact. Although this evidence clearly showed that respondent, that petitioners did not participate in any conspiracy to defraud respondent, and that transport certainly would not have paid $250,000 to someone who had no legal claim. Once again, however, the trial judge prohibited the jury from hearing this evidence, and it had to be introduced on an offer of proof. Similarly, faced with the outright suppression of this evidence, petitioners then looked to the one remaining avenue to vindicate themselves. They sought to introduce testimony from the attorney that transport had hired to obtain court approval of the settlement. At trial, four attorney expert witnesses for respondent testified that the typical procedure for, quote, proving up such a settlement was not followed, and this explained transport's desire to avoid discovery of its deceitful conduct. The fact was, however, that transport had used very reputable attorneys to obtain court approval of the settlement, and their testimony would have totally destroyed this myth. To prevent that from occurring, respondent therefore moved on the first day of trial to quash the trial subpoena served on these attorneys, and the motion was granted by the trial judge prohibiting their testimony. These were the conditions under which petitioners were forced to try this case to a jury. After the close of the evidence, respondent's attorneys then submitted their proposed charge. It was accepted by the trial judge without review and simply handed to me. And then, based on the jury's answers to the questions submitted, judgment was entered by the trial court in favor of respondent. As this court is also aware, the Beaumont Court of Appeals essentially rubber-stamped what occurred in the trial court and never even specifically addressed any of the arguments advanced by petitioners, despite an opinion that exceeded 30 pages in length. Following that event, petitioners then presented with this court with 10 points of error, 9 of which have been accepted for review. This chart that I have prepared, which I hope all the justices are able to see, is a shorthand illustration of the actual questions that were submitted to the jury under the trial court's charge. As the court will note, question 1 submitted an issue on a heretofore unrecognized tort cause of action for breach of a duty of quote-unquote good faith alone. Question 4 inquired about a conspiracy to defraud, and at respondent's request included a finding as to Mike Askins, even though he was not even a defendant in the case. Question 6, which purportedly inquired into violations of Article 2121 of the Insurance Code, was answered in the negative as to all defendants. However, it is true that every other question was answered adversely to at least one of the petitioners. In petitioner's first point of error, petitioners contend that respondent cannot obtain recovery under any of the jury's findings because, based on the incontrovertible evidence that she was neither the natural nor adoptive child of Judith Kirvin, she did not sustain any damages as a matter of law, as she had no standing to pursue any claim. From a legal perspective, the settlement was a windfall. Respondent cannot argue that she was legally damaged by only being paid $250,000 for release of a claim she had no right to assert in the first place.
Counsel, what about the adoption by estoppel argument?
Well, they did not pursue the adoption by estoppel theory at the trial court level. I presented this legal argument that I've just articulated to you to the trial court, thereby putting them on notice that if they did have a standing question, they could have presented a fact issue to the jury on the adoption by estoppel question, but they chose not to do that. And in their brief, they now seem to be asking this court to make a factual finding to this effect, but there was no finding of adoption by estoppel. Moreover, under the Goss versus France case, which was a writ refused case, it was held that the adoption by estoppel doctrine cannot be used to confer wrongful death standing upon a child. As a writ refused case, not only the holding was endorsed, but also the reason underlying the holding. In addition, This court's decision in the Brown v. Edwards transfer case, a 1989 decision by Justice Gonzalez, was one in which the court refused to interpret the term children as it is defined in the probate code. That definition only applies for purposes of distribution of property incident to an estate. And the court held that a wrongful death claim is a different animal, does not belong to an estate, but only to the filial descendants of the decedent, which would include, I'm sorry,
I didn't mean to cut off your answer. My question was, though, that Ms. Faircloth presumably testified she was the child of the decedent, did she not?
Well, in front of the jury, that's what she testified to, but on a...
So at most, if you had been able to offer this evidence, there would have been a fact question?
Well, if someone testifies on a bill of exceptions or offer of proof, I definitely was not her natural or adoptive child. And a birth certificate is introduced of the live birth, contemporaneous with the live birth within a few days, showing that she was the natural child of someone else. Our position is that evidence was conclusive. She only gave false testimony to the contrary because the trial judge was persuaded by the theory offered by respondent's attorneys that the jury was only entitled to consider the information that the insurance company had before it at the time the settlement was consummated. Therefore, although I'm not accusing her of perjury, she was in effect put in the position of playing out a fiction in order to recreate a set of facts that were supposedly understood by the insurance company at the time. The picture frame theory was advanced by respondent's counsel based on the Viles decision that was handed down by this court under the opinion of Justice Doggett. But Viles is not on point. The issue there was simply whether an insured's action for a breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing is barred by a failure to file a proof of loss within the time prescribed by an insurance contract. That case involved a first-party claim that was denied. Here, a third-party claim was paid. Second, the application of the estoppel doctrine in Viles did not create rights. It avoided a forfeiture. Here, the application would create rights, the right to monies on top of other monies, none of which were owed.
So you have no disagreement with Viles. You say it simply does not apply here.
That's correct, Your Honor. It was a first-party case dealing with the breach of a duty of good faith and fair dealing, involving a claim that was not paid, and it's completely distinguishable on its facts and its reason. In your opinion, you did not create rights. You simply said, on behalf of the court, you cannot interpose a condition that you didn't rely on as a means of denying somebody something that they were otherwise entitled to under an insurance contract. That avoided a forfeiture of an existing right. Here, the application would, in effect, create a non-existent right. So I contend that it is simply distinguishable and that Viles stands as a legitimate opinion.
Is there a difference between, back to the adoption by estoppel, wrongful death benefits and survivorship benefits?
There has been no case that states that adoption by estoppel can be a Supreme Court case, can confer standing on someone. But since that's a claim belonging to the estate, there could be reasoning to support the argument that since it belongs to the estate, someone who was adopted by estoppel would be a beneficiary. In this case, however, the uncontroverted evidence was that Judith Kirvin, the only person with whom respondent ultimately claimed she had any sort of legal relationship, died instantly as a result of the accident. Respondent so testified, and the medical records, which were introduced by petitioners into evidence, established and were not disputed that Ms. Kirvin died instantly as a result of the accident, meaning that even if she had attempted to argue, I'm entitled to more money because I had a survivorship claim which was settled for too little, she would not have prevailed as a matter of law because that claim would have been worth nothing given that the decedent sustained no conscious pain and suffering.
As best I've been able to follow your argument to date, to this point, it focuses on the specific facts and circumstances of what you have indicated is a grave injustice that has occurred to your client in this case.
I'm a bit unclear at this point from your argument, as distinguished from your brief, exactly what law it is that you're asking this court to announce in this case, other than to reverse and undo what happened to you over in East Texas.
Well, there are two different avenues that the respondent pursued in order to obtain recovery in the trial court. The common law approach under the duty of good faith, the fiduciary duty, fraud, conspiracy to defraud, and then the effort to recover under the various statutory schemes, which the court is well familiar with. Our position is that with respect to their common law claims, there was absolutely no evidence to support a recovery, both because she suffered no damage as a matter of law and because there was no evidence of any actionable conduct.
Counsel, wasn't the insurance code the sole basis for the trial court's judgment?
Yes, yes, sir.
So would you focus on the basis on which the trial court rendered judgment and tell us why?
Unfortunately, the Court of Appeals simply reproduced the respondent's petition, its last amended petition, in its opinion. And in its holding, in ignoring every point of error that we asserted, affirmed the trial court's judgment under all these theories, even though the trial court itself did not enter judgment on those theories. So out of an abundance of caution, we decided to address all of those arguments.
Would you address the insurance code?
Certainly, Your Honor. Because if point of error number one is not sustained, although we hope that it will be, then point of error number two would be that the judgment, the petitioners would ask the court to consider the merits of their second point of error, that the lower courts erred in permitting an insurance code recovery because there was no evidence that respondent had standing to pursue any claims under the Texas insurance code. Petitioners submit that the court's analysis of this point of error should be considered in light of three sources of authority. Number one, the plain language of Article 2121. Number two, the legislative history behind its enactment. And number three, this court's holding in Allstate versus Watson. For your convenience, I will display for you an enlargement of jury question number five. Question number five was submitted as a question under the insurance code incorporating a provision of the DTPA, which included an award of treble damages and attorney's fees. And that was the award was predicated on a positive response to that question. In this case, it's undisputed, however, that respondent has never been insured under any policy of insurance issued by Transport. As a third-party claimant, she contends that she did have standing to sue Transport and its agents under Article 21-21-16 for any violation of the laundry list provisions enumerated by Section 1746B of the DTPA. Because my time is short, I will run through each and every point we offer on this issue very quickly. Number one, this was not a 1746B question because although it was supposed to be a 1746B23 submission, 1746B23 refers to transactions involving goods and services involving consumers. This transaction did not involve goods and services. It did not involve a consumer. So rather than simply altering the language slightly to conform to the evidence, it materially mutated the terms of that provision. And essentially did what Justice Gonzalez, in his dissenting opinion in Edmund versus Marshall, said should not be allowed. However, if the court does consider it a 1746B claim, then the court has to look at the consequences of such a finding, because in this particular case, the only evidence which related to that particular issue was that although the insurance company settled for $250,000, it had received an informal advice from attorneys consulted by telephone that in the various venues where this case might be filed, the award could be somewhat higher, possibly up to $500,000. In light of that evidence, the jury was asked, did we intend to induce her into a transaction by failing to disclose a material fact? Well, it certainly would have been material to her that an attorney had advised the insurance company that the award might be somewhat higher. They may not have settled if they had known that fact. But if that gives a basis for recovery under that particular statutory provision, then in effect, it's imposing on an insurance carrier a duty to disclose on behalf of its policyholder and the defendant whose interest it's representing in a piece of litigation against an adversary disclosed to the adversary facts that historically and traditionally in our adversary system all have recognized deserve to be shielded in order to advance the interests of the defendant as aggressively and well as possible. Thus, it would put the insurance carrier in a position where if it disclosed, if it does engage in settlement negotiations, it has to breach a duty to settlement. Either it violates the duty owed to the third-party claimant by failing to disclose, for example, reserves on the claim, payment history on similar claims, information harmful to the insured's liability exposure, communications with the insured that the law ordinarily recognizes as privileged, or the insurer faces a claim from the insured for the damage caused to it by the insurer's disclosure of all this information.
Any questions? Counsel, I believe you have 2 minutes left for rebuttal at the conclusion of the respondent's argument.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. George Chandler and Mr. Brent Farney will present arguments for the respondent. Mr. Chandler will present approximately the first 15 minutes.
Your Honors, you told us in Nautipetad that an insurance company must answer for its sins, that it's not immune. You told us that the law is not a shield for an insurance company committing sins. That's what this case is all about. Judge Gamage, you asked an interesting question about adoption by estoppel. One reason this was not addressed more thoroughly, although it's in the record replete with the fact that there is sufficient evidence as a matter of law to constitute adoption by estoppel. The only evidence in this record is a birth certificate that shows this child as being the child of Judith Kirbin, deceased. The trial court carefully weighed the birth certificates. The birth certificates proffered by Transport Insurance Company was one certified to by a city clerk from Texas City.
Why shouldn't the trier of fact rather than the trier of law make that way?
Because, Your Honor, it's a question of law. The statute itself says that a birth certificate must meet certain requisites. The one that we proffered, incidentally, the one that plaintiff's proffered, Judge Phillips, was tendered and found by Janet Jones, a defendant adjuster, who told us that this was the birth certificate. She found it. We didn't find it. She said that she believed that was a valid birth certificate at the time of the settlement, and it was a valid birth certificate at the time of trial. The trial court looked at the birth certificate tendered and offered by the insurance company and found it did not meet the minimum statutory requisites. It was not certified to by the Bureau of Vital Statistics. It was trying to disprove. We had a valid birth certificate. So the only evidence in the record, Your Honor, from a valid birth certificate is that she is the adopted child. That is the only evidence in this.
The birth certificate met all the legal requisites?
Yes, sir, it did, the one we proffered. And Judge Stover, although he's basically called a fraud, the trial judge in this case by transport, if the court will review how much detail the court went to in looking and discussing these two birth certificates and made a ruling that one met the law and one did not. This child's birth certificate found by Transport Insurance Company at the time of the settlement met the requisites of law. The one obtained 2 weeks before trial that we saw for the first time did not meet the requisites of law.
Did your client make an out-of-court statement that she was not the child of this woman?
No, sir. And I'm glad you asked that, Your Honor. Here's what my client said in court in the Bill of Exceptions. And I read from the Statement of Facts on page 2480, I might add, conveniently, Transport Insurance Company stopped at page 74 or 2479 in setting out Paula Triffel's testimony. Question, Paula, for all of your life, have you looked upon Judith? Or did you look upon her before her death, Judith, as your mother? Answer, yes, sir, I did. Question, at an early age, did Judith tell you that you were chosen, that you were adopted? Answer, yes, sir, she did. Question, did you always believe all of your life, up until May or even up until now, that you were legally adopted? Answer, that's what I believe. And that's what was the yes, sir.
I know we're arguing about the birth certificates, but it... could a jury have awarded, assuming that Ms. Faircloth was the natural daughter or adopted daughter, could a jury, under the facts of the damages in this case, awarded $250,000?
Yes, Your Honor, and let me go ahead and
Could they have awarded $100,000?
Well, according to the only expert witnesses called at the trial, the jury would likely have awarded significant punitive damages as well. This wreck involved...
Could the jury have awarded $100,000?
Well, Judge, I guess they could have done anything.
Okay, so they settled at $250,000. What about the facts of the settlement of $250,000 is so shocking about this
case? Okay, sir. Your Honor, this wreck happened May the 15th, 1984, near Coleman Hill, Texas. Both of this child's parents were killed by a truck in the wrong lane of traffic, but according to the insurance company's records, indicated the two trucks were racing. On May the 15th, 1984, it is undisputed that transport dispatched insurance adjusters that went to the home and to the funeral home to visit to try to settle the case. The insurance adjusters, it's undisputed.
A violation of some sort of duty?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it is under the facts of this case. I think they violated the rights of an orphan child because they told her that she had to settle and settle fast, and all she could get was $250,000, and the jury found that was fraud, and I believe it was too.
And was a guardian appointed for the child?
Yes, Your Honor, the guardian was appointed at the suggestion of the insurance company, who paid the bond and prepared the guardian application 3 days after the funeral.
And was an attorney appointed to represent
the same attorney? Yes, Your Honor, the attorney was appointed, Mike Askins, who was recommended by Transport Insurance Company because he allegedly had been an adjuster for Transport Insurance Company in the past. And unless he was hired, there was a good chance she would get nothing. That's the record of this case, and that's what the jury heard.
And a probate judge presided over that?
Yes, Your Honor. A friendly suit was not filed. The insurance company prepared the application to approve the settlement. In the application, I might add, Your Honor, adjudicated the fact she was a legal child. But they chose instead not to have it presented to a district court by a friendly suit and a guardian ad litem, but placed it before a judge who was not a lawyer in Woodville, Texas. No record was made of that hearing.
So you like Judge Stover, but you don't like the probate judge?
I think the probate judge, he was not a lawyer. He did not realize the fraud that had been perpetrated. Paula had no lawyer. He did not know that Paula had been led to believe that the law was so-called about to change, and if she didn't settle, and they settled her case within 25 days of the date of her parents, of the death of her folks. And I call them her folks because both of this man and this woman, were the only parents she ever knew. The birth certificate reflected she was brought home by the hospital by June. I think that was fraud, and the probate judge didn't hear that. An ad litem would have inquired, and probably a district judge would have inquired. And all the expert witnesses that testified said that particularly where an orphan's involved, you've got to closely scrutinize and use the utmost of care. And even Janet Jones, the defendant, testified that it was of utmost importance to protect the rights of this child and to do it the right way. And they misled her. And the jury promptly found fraud. The facts of this case, Your Honor, is clearly that and the insurance company had a representative there in Coleman Hill the day of the wreck, May 15, 1984. They visited Paul at the funeral home May 16th or so at before the funeral. Janet Jones talked to Paula, gained an orphan child's trust, told her we'll take care of you, and at the same time said that it was important that she settled fast, that she accept $250,000 or she would get nothing. And you know, that was there was never a demand made by Mr. Askins. His fee was paid directly by the insurance company. He was not out one cent of expense. Even his investigation, the wreck report, yes.
I want to be real clear on the facts.
Yes, Your Honor.
You say the settlement was approved by a non-lawyer county judge acting in probate?
Yes, Your Honor.
There was no guardian ad litem?
No,
there was no attorney in ad litem?
No, sir.
Evidence before the jury in this trial was there evidence before the jury in this trial that the
attorney that was appointed by the probate court had some relationship with the insurance carrier?
Absolutely. And the attorney from that represented her, although within subpoena range, did not come and testify.
Mr. Chairman, would you distinguish the basis upon which the trial court rendered judgment
yes,
in this
Your
case
Honor.
From Allstate versus Watson?
Yes, Your Honor. The trial court rendered judgment, and it entered it, he said it could enter three different ways, and I opted to do it under Article 2121, vis-a-vis 1746B. But we had listed and unlisted findings of the violation of Article 1746, so we had it rendered under 2121, which we believe to be the proper way. Back on the facts, which I think are so important in this case.
Does that distinguish this from Allstate versus Watson?
Yes, I think it does, Your Honor. In Allstate versus Watson, I believe you said it had to be to get through 2121 to have standing, you had to have a listed violation, and we did of 1746.
Well, I thought we said that the third-party claimant didn't have standing under the statute, which, and why is Ms. Faircloth a third-party claimant?
Well, Your Honor, they undertook to deal with it. And they dealt with her and they defrauded her. They committed actionable fraud and there was a finding to that effect. And surely 2121 came
well, to you. Have, don't you have to rely on the basis upon which the trial court rendered judgment? I mean, you can't rely on these other bases upon which you pled for judgment, which the trial court did not render judgment on, can you?
Well, Your Honor, but 2121 clearly states that any violation of 1746 is a violation of 2121. And we have... It's undeniable in the indubitable evidence and finding of the jury that there was a violation of 1746, and that's the way we got to 2121. And the argument of the insurance company truly is that they somehow can use 2121 as a shield to protect it from fraud to an orphan. And a few steps over here, when that law was passed, I know that was not the intent. 2121 was to protect consumers. And particularly to protect the fragile rights of a little girl who had lost everything, who knew no one, in a little rural community where she had nobody, and she was overreached, and she was wronged, and the jury found it, and they heard it all. And about this birth certificate question, and it's so important, the only legal birth certificate in the record proves that her mother was killed. And Transport furnished that birth certificate. And Transport has said in their brief that I fabricated.
Did opposing counsel say that the guardian and the guardian's attorney knew of the circumstances at the time of the settlement?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that's what I understood.
Is that in the record?
Yes, Your Honor. It is undisputed that at the time of the settlement hearing, Reverend Troy Caldwell, who was the guardian, who was visited by Janet Jones the night of the wreck. And it was discussed then that there needed to be a guardianship taken out. And Caldwell then went and found Askins, along with Janet Jones, who was part of that conversation where Askins was hired. And this was all in the record of the case.
No, I understood that opposing counsel said that the guardian knew at the time of the settlement that
he did. I'm sorry, but
that the board might not have been had standing.
Well, that's just not proof. Askins said, Your Honor, in the trial of the in the trial court, Askins testified that through this is the lawyer that throughout this is his actual testimony, and it's on page 2300 of the statement of facts. That throughout Paula's life, Judith, the deceased, established both for Paula and herself the relationship at all times of a mother and child. There is no testimony to the contrary, absolutely none. And as a matter of fact, there couldn't be. It's the law of this state.
The other side seemed to argue a while ago that both the lawyer and the guardian knew that plaintiff wasn't the daughter of the deceased, and they proceeded to settlement very hurriedly because they were afraid she wouldn't get anything because there was no legal relationship.
That's, I know
is
he
there
said,
anything in the record?
No, Judge, there isn't. I read Askins' testimony to that effect.
Just argument.
That's just argument. It's just false. The fact of the matter is, and let's just assume, though, that it was true. It was wrong. Because the birth certificate, the only valid birth certificate, showed that was her mother. But that was not the record of the case. And the court weighed these birth certificates and looked at the one proffered by the insurance company and found it did not meet the statutory requisites. And the law of this state has been ever since we've had...
The insurance company proffered both of them, didn't they?
Yes, sir, they did. Thank you for mentioning that. They proffered the good one and the bogus one. And now they want to scream about the bogus one that did not meet the statutory requisites. And ever since there's been a Supreme Court of Texas, it is always held that if you want to try to legitimatize a child and look to every way not to bastardize it.
Mr. Chandler, if a majority of this court were to determine that recovery is barred under Allstate against Watson, would there be any other basis for recovery for your...
Your Honor, I would hope that under common law fraud, there would be...
And in the nature of the judgment and the basis for the judgment that was entered in this case, what would be the proper disposition if a majority of the court determined that Allstate against Watson controlled?
If a majority of this court, Your Honor, said that Allstate versus Watson controlled and tossed Paul out of this court, I would hope there would be a remand where this case could be tried solely on the fraud basis, and not where we go home with a complete empty spoon. Because the jury found fraud. And I truly believe that Watson versus Allstate preserved 2121. If there's a violation of 1746, that's the clear language of the statute. And once they undertook the deal, whether they had to do so honestly and fairly. I hope I answered your question, Judge. I understand my dilemma with Watson versus Allstate. I understand.
Are you saying if there were any dealings, even if no payment had been made, but there were merely preliminary negotiations, then the Allstate rule doesn't apply?
No, Judge Phillips. I'm not asking to open up Pandora's box where I know in Texas, and I've been at this 32 years suing, I know I can't sue a liability haul off and just sue them. I know that you've got to sue the part claimant.
So you're saying there has to be a completed contract?
Yes, sir. There has to be. And here we've got fraud. We don't have just, they wouldn't talk to me, or they wouldn't call me, or they wouldn't deal with me. They lied to me. Whether it was lying to you about the amount of coverage that was applicable causing you to settle, whether they lied to you about this, that, or the other, if they're going to do it, they've got to do it fair and can't commit fraud, particularly to an orphan, particularly to a little girl that's 15 years old, who does not have a completed high school education. That's my position. Brent. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Brent Farley, who argued for responsibility in the remaining time.
May it please the court, I'll hit three areas very quickly, if I might. Justice Cornyn, in response to your inquiry concerning Watson, the reason this is different from Watson is that we secured a jury finding on question number two that is unlike anything in Watson because we established an independent basis to impose the special relationship that this court wants in connection with 2121 actions under its reasoning in Vail.
There's a special relationship between adversaries?
There is not a special relationship between adversaries, Your Honor. What we proved in this case is that there was no true adversarial nature in the proceeding. We secured a yes answer that there was a co-conspiracy of all five actors, including Transport Insurance Company, in connection, again, in terms of special relationship, with a minor. And I think her status as a minor, as opposed to Ms. Watson's as an adult, is critical.
Have we ever recognized the duty you are asserting in a third-party claimant context as opposed to a first-party context?
I do not think that has been specifically recognized by this court, Your Honor. I would merely suggest as a lawyer representing a client appealing to the highest court of this state that 2121 applies to any person. Paula Triple Faircloth is seated out there. She fits that definition. Secondly, that no reconciliation with or reference to any precedent is necessary for this court to observe that a jury
made an affirmative determination as to all defenses on a section 1746B, number 23, question submitted in substantially correct form.
Would it be correct to say you're arguing then for an extension of existing law?
No, Your Honor. I believe I'm arguing for, not for an extension, but a clarification by this court that Watson does not exclude all persons dealt with by an insurance company on a third-party basis from the purview of 2121, that 2121 is more than a paper tiger.
Well, where's the cutoff? Anytime the insurance company makes a statement to a claimant against one of its insureds that would potentially open up 1746 liability, which would get to 2121. Is that your position?
The insurance company
that writes a check without comment may be all right.
Your Honor, I believe that the problem with this analysis in applying a blanket rule is that it is so fact-specific, case by case. I think that if they're dealing with a minor under these circumstances, that's going to be true. If they're dealing with an adult like Ms. Watson, that's obviously not true. I really think it may be important for the court to consider the establishment of an independent basis of a special relationship between an insurer and the person it's dealing with, which we did establish in answer to jury question number two.
Ms. Bonney, you take these facts. The insurance company has a liability out there. One of their insureds causes an accident. The cause of the accident perhaps is not in dispute. The insurance company comes upon the scene and what they're presented with is a minor child. What under your view of this case is the duty of the insurance company? What steps do they take according to what you think the law should be?
And I may respond, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
Your Honor, the steps they should take is, first of all, make the decision, am I going to deal with this child?
Well, they don't have any. I mean, okay.
And if they choose to deal with the child, they must deal with that child fairly in a confidential relationship, particularly under these types of circumstances. If they choose not to, if they want to go the conventional route,
do they have a choice not to deal with the child?
Absolutely.
So the insurance company could refuse to talk to the child?
The insurance company could have refused to talk to this child. They could have waited, and I think this is also so unique from Watson. This child never made a claim. They came to her, and through Askins and Caldwell, as the record would reflect, settled what they call her possible claim. She never had the opportunity to wait until she got 18 to think for another 2 years whether she wanted to bring a claim against Allied Van Lines. They came down and said, you have a claim, and this is fair, and you should take this amount of money. And I think the amount of money is really a red herring in this case, because Transport Insurance Company would have this court apply the same reasoning if they'd only paid $10,000, $5,000.
But wouldn't the insured have a claim against the insurance company for failure to represent them by approaching this minor child under these circumstances? I mean, the insurance company has a duty to its insured to also look out for its insured interests.
Absolutely, Your Honor. It has a duty to look out for its insured's interest. On the other hand, in looking out for its insured's interest, I think that if that is where its loyalties lie, it cannot give the impression to lay people or other people that it's also dealing with them and it's in their corner as well. And that perhaps is the biggest problem in dealing with the minor, and it's why the jury found that in these circumstances, where the adjuster literally the day after the wreck
was there ever anybody at any time in this whole process charged with responsibility of purely safeguarding the interests of a corporate matter?
Absolutely not.
Nobody.
Absolutely not.
The lawyer wasn't. He wasn't an advisor. He took a third of the recovery, did he not?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Wasn't there a guardian in probate?
Yes, there was a guardian. Guardian Caldwell, Reverend Caldwell. And Reverend Caldwell took Paula Triple into his home and let her share a room with his granddaughter for $700 a month until she got out of high school and was able to get out of the house and petition the court for the release of the remainder of her funds. And there's other evidence in the records to suggest his motives were less than pure and altruistic. Unless my time is up,
it is.
All this evidence was before the jury. All of this was an evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. So much more than a scintilla. The no evidence rule just clearly kicks them out on their evidentiary analysis.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Allow him to state what counsel wants to state.
Ask the question.
What is it that your counsel wants to hear? Please tell me.
The one thing, Your Honor, that we think is very important, too, is on these theories, should this court decide that 2121 isn't the proper vehicle for the court to render this judgment, the court can see in the trial court's judgment it made an analysis of each of the theories of recovery on which it could write a judgment and then chose one of them on which to write a judgment. This court could remand it to the trial court to enter judgment on any of the number of other theories entered for which there was recovery, which did include fraud.
We would have to do that in the interest of justice. On what theory would we reverse the Court of Appeals and remand it to the trial court for entry of another judgment?
It would simply be on a reformation basis, as we would understand it, Judge, to reform the judgment to reflect that 2121 recovery was not permissible, but because of alternative jury findings on common law fraud, civil conspiracy, either of those would get to the actual and exemplary damages.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you to pick up with this last comment that he just made, and that is, if you are right about Allstate against Watson and wrong about the common law fraud claim, is the disposition that he suggested an appropriate one?
There is appellate authority to the effect that a court of appeals can enter a judgment based on other findings made by the jury that would support the judgment. I would note that the two other theories under which the trial judge's judgment says recovery is proper are not proper. They offer four times actual damages, or they combine exemplary and common law, exemplary damages and additional damages under the DTPA in another theory. So,
but we could remand to the trial court to look at another theory and enter a judgment that might be for a lesser amount based on the findings, since a party has the right to elect the theory of recovery that would get the greatest recovery.
My understanding is that it would be this court that would do that, would reform it based upon any other theory on which the judgment would have been proper and recovery would have been proper. But probably if I could leave you with one point today, it would be this. There has been disagreement about what this record has included from the first moment that Mr. Chandler and I both opened our mouths. We've cited to you excerpts from the record which we contend support our position about what the record has shown, and we stand by those citations, and we ask this court to be the first to look at the record and to realize that Miller's statements are completely incorrect. The insurance company did not prepare the guardianship papers. There is no evidence to that effect. There was no representation that any law was about to change to the minor. There was no representation that Mr. Askins had a relationship with the insurance carrier. He apparently had stated that he had once been an adjuster for Allied Van Lines, the insured. Ms. Triple, on page 2469 of the record, was asked, "Ms. Faircloth, Judith Kirvin was not the woman who gave birth to you. Is that right?" Answer, "That's correct." "Marvin Kirvin is not your natural father." "That's correct." "And you're not aware of any court proceeding that ever took place which involved Judith Kirvin adopting you. Is that right?" "Not as far as any legal procedures, no. I mean, that's right. I don't know of any."
And your time has expired. Were there any questions?
That was evidence offered by bill of exception.
Yes, sir.
The jury did not hear that evidence?
No, he did not.
Your Honor, may I?
You've got the floor, so.
Second.
Our judges have other comments, but we will review the records. Are there any other questions? Court will take a brief recess, and we will return to the record.